podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. India levelled the series in Chennai as they thumped England by 317 runs ahead of the day-night test at Ahmedabad starting next week. I'm Yaz Rana, and to discuss the test, its many talking points, and a whole lot more in the world of international cricket this week, I'm joined by the magazine editor of Wisden Cricket Monthly, Joe Harmon, the features editor of Wisden.com, Tahir Hashim, and the managing editor of Wisden.com, Ben Gardner. As much as it pains me to do so, let's just get the pitch talk out the way at the start. Labelled a stinker by Michael Vaughan, unacceptable by Mark Waugh. Tahir, do you have a problem with a pitch that takes a test well into its fourth day where one team scored over 600 runs?
Like you said, India scored more than 600 runs in the match. I think the criticism is pretty nonsensical. It wasn't impossible to bat. In many ways, I'd argue that this wicket was better than the one in the first test. When I say better, I mean a wicket that offered up consistency throughout the whole match. So in the first test, England won the toss. It was flat for the first couple of days, and then it just starts playing tricks when India started batting. Here it was turning early. It's just that England didn't bowl as well as India did. England didn't bat as well as India did. It's pretty simple as that. I've found the pitch chat pretty tedious and a bit unnecessary.
Yeah, I thought it was quite telling that England haven't criticised pitch publicly, at least yet. Root didn't after the game, and none of the guys who did press duty during the test match did either. So I think that's all we need to say about the pitch. It's kind of what you expect in India, as Joe Root has said. Moving on, for me, the test, if not quite decided, was well on course for its eventual result on day one. Rohit Sharma was out of this world, 161 on a turning wicket. Joe, how good was that innings? And how much do you think he was aided by England just not quite being on it on that opening day?
He was certainly aided by some of England's attack not being quite on it. That said, I thought he got a little bit lost over the course of the test match, but Ollie Stone's first spell was absolutely superb. He could have had more wickets. That was not an easy session of batting because of the pitch and because of the excellence of Stone. Moen was a bit loose. Stuart Broad wasn't quite at his best. So there were runs on offer, but I think on balance, I think we need to talk more about the brilliance of Rohit than England's shortcomings, at least in relation to that innings. You say it was almost done on day one. I didn't feel quite like that, but certainly by lunch on day two, England's 39 for four at that stage, I think the game was up then, which, without going into detail about the pitch, again, just shows how ridiculous that argument is. The pitch didn't change that much from day one to day two, and the game is over by lunch on day two. And I think there's a bit of frustration in some of the criticism as well, because I think neutrals as well as England fans would have been disappointed that the match is basically over after four sessions, and Test cricket isn't great in those circumstances, so that was disappointing. But I wouldn't blame the pitch. I'd blame Rohit Sharma's brilliance, obviously from then it was just England fighting against the tide. And it was a pretty chastening test of the kind we've become used to when England visit India.
Just on Rohit, I kind of find it amazing that he's a undisputed ODI great, undisputed IPL great, yet it's taken him so, and he does so in such a classy way. It looks technically sound. It surprised me it's taken this long, Ben, for him to get a prolonged go in Test cricket and kind of show everyone that he can actually be a brilliant test match opening batsman as well, at least in India.
It's surprising, I guess, when you look at it in like a big picture way, but I think when you actually drill down into his career, there's loads of great ODI batsmen who have struggled to crack test cricket because it's a different game where, you know, the white ball doesn't move around much. And that's been his downfall, especially away from home, is the ball's seeming and slight technical deficiencies there. I guess he does look a very technically correct player, but equally, I mean, I think you can easily, if you look very elegant, people can take that to mean the same thing as having sort of like a pristine technique that's going to be able to deal with seam movement, but I don't think they are the same thing, really. I think that you can easily, you know, if you're driving sort of on the up and very languidly, that can then translate to sort of playing early and then getting caught out when the ball's doing a bit. So it's a surprise in some way, but not in others. And his record has always been very good in India from his first two test matches when he made 200s in two games against West Indies back in Sachin's farewell series. But I think what's interesting is how he'll go in England this summer, because I thought he was brilliant in spurts in Australia, but didn't get a big score and often got himself out after battling through really tough new ball periods. And this ensures that he'll definitely open in that series for me, I think. But also, I think there's a real chance that he could sort of make a belated claim to be sort of like an all-format great rather than just an ODI great. He never cracked Test cricket. So yeah, and then this was, for me, his best Test innings and like his most valuable for India as well, considering the state of the pitch and just how much better he looked than everyone else, basically. Because he, obviously other players scored runs, but he did it in a way that sort of seemed like he was playing on a different surface, whereas other players found a way to sort of negotiate the challenges of the pitch, I guess. And that was partly to do with England, but mostly to do with how good he was, as Joe says.
Yeah, on that, do you think that we kind of didn't see this with England because England didn't bat long enough to see the benefits of it? But I thought that batting did actually look easier once the ball got older. I don't think there's anything to do with the pitch, but I think Ashwin's talked about how the ball hasn't been ideal from a bowler's point of view. Do you think that's fair? And do you think that came into it at all? That once you kind of get through the first 30, 40 overs, the batting became more manageable against the older ball?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think that, I mean, with the pitch chat, I think I'm probably slightly more understanding of people who are critical of the pitch than Taha and Joe are. I think that when you see the ball turn that much in the first session of day one, it's easy to think, okay, this is going to be an absolute minefield by the time it gets to day three. But also the pitch didn't seem to get that much worse throughout the test either. It wasn't like it was breaking up loads, and it wasn't like it started with loads of rough patches. It just started being sort of kind of underprepared in a way, I guess. So it both was kind of the same for all teams all the way through, which is, as Taha says, isn't the same as the first test pitch. And you're right, I think it definitely did get easier to bat. And you saw that, I think, with Ben Folkes' innings as well as he played. I think it was partly down to the fact that he had slightly easier conditions, and with Ashwin and Virat as well on day three. So yeah, I think if England could have battled through those first couple of hours, only 2 wickets, 1 wicket down, we could have actually seen a much closer test match. Yeah, as Joe says, it was just all done by the first session on day two.
Let's get on to Moeen then. A wonderfully Moeen test. He picked up England's best figures in both innings, although he was quite loose in the first, going at 5 and over for much of the first innings. Then he hit 43 of 18 in England's second innings, the highest score of the test match for an England player. And it was very nearly the quickest test match 50 of all time. Quite a lot to pack into one test. And now he's going back to the UK for the rest of the test leg of the tour, going home as originally scheduled. Joe, what do you make of that?
It is Moeen Ali's last test match, and I think there's a decent chance, regrettably, that it might be. What a way to go. What a Moeen way to go overall, to clean up India's captain with a massive turning off break, but basically bowl quite badly in the first innings. I did actually think he bowled much better in the second innings. There was signs of control coming in there, less full tosses. And yeah, that little kind of cameo at the end was classically Moeen. I have to say, and I'm not sure if this is just my poor knowledge, I wasn't aware that he was going home at the end of this test match. They're talking about this as though it's pre-planned, but I wasn't personally aware that was the case. So that was a surprise to me this morning. And it does make it all look a bit messy that Best got dropped for Moeen, which might have been a dent to Best's confidence. And now Moeen's going home. I thought that could have been managed a bit better. They could have said, well, if Moeen's going home, then Moeen gets this test match to give Best a breather, so he's in good nick for the third and fourth test. Instead, it looks like they've kind of, no one's come out of it feeling particularly great, I think. And it's a shame that Moeen's not there for the third test, because as I say, he was starting to bowl a bit better. But yeah, if you could encapsulate Moeen in one test match, I think this would probably be it.
It's pretty understandable that he's going home. He had COVID, and he spent plenty of time in isolation on this tour as well. I think we overlook these things pretty easily sometimes, and just expect people to come onto the park with sort of no external issues. But it is really sad to see him go, because he was going into the match, you know, like Joe mentioned, He didn't bowl as well in the first innings, and then by the second innings, he was looking a lot better, and that would sort of set him up perfectly for the last two tests, because you know he's not had a warm up match. He's barely played any cricket in the last 5 months, and then when you look at obviously the decision to drop Best for the first test, it kind of felt like Moeen was now like ready to he was set for the next three tests, and even though England were losing this game early on, Moeen would get the chance to get some overs under his belt and get ready for the next two tests. I think at the start of the series, he'd said that it was likely he was going to be rested for the back end of this series, but depending on how he would bowl, how he'd play, that could have changed. But obviously, he's going home now. I think it's quite sad as well. A lot of the reason it's quite sad as well is just the way he batted at the end there as well. He's obviously a really good player of spin. England could have even reconfigured their lineup for the next test and maybe had him in the top six, top seven, where you can get another seamer and play for a pink ball test, which would have been really good for the balance. It's pretty likely that this could be his last test, especially if Jack Leach or Don Best now becomes the number one spinner and you just see that one spinner in England, which would be a massive shame. I think it's a massive shame that we've had England have six tests in the subcontinent this winter. And Moeen Ali, who I still think is England's best spinner, is just going to play one of them. And Moeen Ali, who's one of England's best players spin, is going to play one of them. It's sad to see all round, but obviously it's totally understandable it's going home. The way England have framed it is a bit strange, obviously, saying that he's chosen to go home when initially there was the suggestion that he was always going to be rested for the back half of the series. And then to go with the fact that he's been in and out of the ODI and the white ball squads recently, I imagine he'll play in India because they'll want the second spinner, but he's not been a nail on the white ball stuff. So in my mind, I was thinking, you know, if you're going to use him during this period of time, use him for the entirety of the red ball thing.
Yeah, I think you're both bang on in that. Well, quite a few parties don't come out of this looking particularly great. I'd say that Moeen isn't one of those parties. I think that, you know, he has to take decisions which are best for his own welfare. And he played well in this test. And yeah, so there's no blame being put on him. But Taha's right. I think it was Joe Root who said that Moeen's chosen to, whereas the other players have had the decision framed as this is when they are being rested, which puts an unnecessary amount of sort of agency on Moeen. Or it's just strange how it's been framed differently for different players. But I would suggest that it shouldn't be Joe Root who's doing that in the first place. If this is about player welfare and, you know, full selection decision, this should be the coach and the team management, really, rather than sort of a captain who's just come out of like a pretty chastening loss, having to sort of like talk about quite a delicate issue like that. So I think that also reflects not great. And there's also just a strange inconsistency about it, and the fact that Moeen's going to be back in India for the T20I series, as is Jos Buttler, but Jos Buttler went home after the first game and Moeen's going home after the second. So it feels like if Jos Buttler has to do that to get a significant amount of time at home, Moeen's actually not going to get too much time at home if he's going to be linking up again in time for... I mean, Jos Buttler's going to be back in India by the time the third test starts and Moeen's going after the second test ends, and they're both going to start playing cricket again at the same time. I kind of feel like England's a laudable rotation policy, and at least in intention, and they're trying to be flexible and forward-thinking and understanding, and that's all very good. I think they've actually sort of boxed themselves into a new sort of rigidity in a different sort of way. I think the other thing that comes into it as well is we don't yet know whether Moeen will be playing in the IPL because the draft is on Thursday. He doesn't currently have a contract. If it turns out he's not, then you wonder if he could have missed some or the T20Is or even just the ODIs and then the IPL, and if that might have been something that was discussed a bit more, and if England just said, okay, let's wait just a couple of days, see if you get a deal, reevaluate then how you're feeling, and if that was discussed as well. It feels like there's both sort of like a lack of clarity over how the whole discussions have gone, and that in a way it's difficult to question these things when they're put forward, because you don't want to be seen to be questioning, you know, the overall importance of mental health, which is definitely paramount. I think you can... there are legitimate questions to ask about England's policy in this case.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. The word being used to describe England's policy quite a lot is laudable. Everyone thinks it's a good thing that they're taking players' well-being into account. Everyone knows how much cricket England have in the next year and how much the all-format players have in particular. But I think the problem most England fans who are questioning it are having isn't that England shouldn't be resting players, it's when they are resting players. And if this is the opportunity he's given to rest, I don't think anyone's criticising Moeen for taking the opportunity. It's just this is a player who is really, really important to England's success in this particular test series. Being rested and then being available for white ball series that no one really sees as anywhere near as important as a test series that's all to play for in India. I guess England are kind of saved a little bit by the next test being a day-night test, so they can more feasibly go into it with just Leach as the sole spinner. I don't know what you guys think about how they'll go to replace Moeen for the third and then fourth test.
I just want to say that I do fear that Moeen is going to be the one who is going to suffer in terms of the narrative that's going to be shaped from this, in terms of them saying that he asked to go home. There's always been a level of mismanagement with Moeen Ali in terms of England, you know, them not giving him a central contract, that when he was a regular fixture in the side, moving him up and down the order. And so I do think that certain people will blame Moeen unfairly, that is. But in terms of replacing him, I think they'll just, well, the squad they picked for the third test is Don Bess is back into that 17-man squad. I think they'll still go with him. I mean, at the same time, in terms of pink ball test, the only time there's been a pink ball test in India, all the quicks, none of the Indian spinners took any wickets, so they could just go with Leach. But I still think in India, you still want that option of having two spinners. You still don't really know what the formula is for playing pink ball tests in India. I think Bess will have to play at least one of the next two tests. And so it's a weird situation, isn't it? Because how is it that he's been dropped because he's being inconsistent? How has he somehow in a week managed to become consistent again, you know? But this is just the situation they can find themselves in. And I was even thinking maybe if they were going to go for one of the reserve spinners, but I think now they've picked Bess. You know, it's just going to be interesting to see how he responds to being dropped after that first test.
I think the interesting thing is how well Joe Root bowled in the game just gone as well. I mean, you could make a claim that he is as reliable an off-spinner as Don Bess. You can get a bit sucked into that because obviously it was a very favourable pitch that Root was bowling on, and he was bowling at a time when England actually managed to kind of keep the run rate down quite well and had India under wraps for a bit there. So you don't want to read too much into this. But as Dahar says, the spinners aren't expected to do quite as much in the pink ball test, and England could potentially get an extra seamer in there and have Root as a backup second spinner who seems to be bowling well. And then you potentially still got Lawrence there to bowl a few overs. That is potentially quite a tempting way to go. But so much of it will depend on what that pitch looks like. We can talk about pink ball. We can talk about the floodlights. But obviously the pitch is still what needs to be bowled on. And I don't think after what we've just seen, India are going to be putting down a green seamer for England to exploit. I think it's still going to deteriorate quickly. I think India will back themselves that even if they lost the toss on the pitch that we've just seen in the second test, they would have gone on to win that match. And I think from the way England batted in both innings and the way India batted in their second innings, I think there's a lot to be said for that. So I think there'll be another turner, albeit England seamers will hope to get more out of the pink ball and the floodlights.
I think the other thing for me to question is, I think you can legitimately question the importance that England are putting on white ball cricket in general this year. I mean, this is players, so players aren't being rested so they can play the T20 World Cup. They're being rested so they can play in a warm-up series for T20 World Cup. When this is the thing that matters in Test cricket for England this year, this and the Ashes and the home series against India. And I think this is different to the 2019 World Cup, which was on home soil. You know, there wasn't much else going on sports-wise when that tournament was on. That was the chance that England saw and had built up to for 4 years to sort of rejuvenate sort of a public that had kind of almost forgotten cricket had existed in a way. Whereas this is going to be, the T20 World Cup is just nowhere near as important as the 2019 World Cup for me in terms of that overall big picture, which is why there was part of the justification in putting so much emphasis on it. You know, it's going to be played in November. There's going to be football on at the same time. It's going to be the other side of the world. It's going to be really hard to drum up the same level of excitement. Whereas this is, you know, the series that's being diminished is, I mean, you know, it's partly by chance, but it's on free-to-air TV. If England could have, you know, won this in dramatic circumstances, or if they could have given themselves the best chance to, in terms of the ECB's other remit, as well as the national team success of ensuring the longevity of cricket in the country is, like, you know, at the forefront of the conversation, ensuring that this series was, like, as hotly contested as possible is much more important to me than either the five-match T20Is that follow or the T20 World Cup. I also don't really buy the argument that Owen Morgan got, you know, screwed over last summer by having to have a weakened team, so Joe Root has to suck up this time, because last summer, like, Morgan had close to a full-strength team for that Australian-Pakistan series and was only really for the Ireland games when England were weakened, whereas Root is without his best side for four tests, which could go a long way towards defining his captaincy and keeping him in his job. I mean, if England get hammered in these next two and then all of a sudden it goes a little bit pear-shaped against New Zealand, who are very good because they're sort of, you know, they've lost momentum and some players are out of form and stuff, that's like you're getting close to pressure on Joe Root again, and that's a quite unfair position to put him in. So I think that prioritisation for me does smart as well, and it's not the way I would have gone. I mean, I know that, you know, we're supposed to see them as equal at the moment, but I don't think that a five-match T20I series bilateral in India is ever going to have the same importance as a test series in India, and I think that's okay, and it's odd that we're trying to be convinced that they are the same.
I agree with Ben that this test series is more important than the T20 World Cup, but I think there is an assumption there that Ed Smith or the ECB are making these decisions. What they've emphasised all the way through, that there is a conversation being had with these players. I was just reading George DeBell's piece on Crick Info about Moeen Ali's test match and going home, and he intimates that this was Moeen's decision. Moeen was asked to pick the point that he wanted to have a break, as all three format players have been asked to do, and Moeen picked this part of the test series. Now, I don't know for sure that that's true, but George does know Moeen well, and there are reasons why Moeen would want to do that. He's kind of clinging onto his T20 place a little bit. So this is difficult. We can have these conversations, but we don't really know where that balance lies. We're told there is a conversation had between the ECB and the player. We don't know quite how much influence the player has in those conversations. I thought it was interesting, Johnny Best, though, on the Channel 4 coverage the other day, talking about going home for a rest. And he seemed quite chilled about it all, which, you know, maybe he doesn't have much choice. Maybe that's just what he has to say. But that's not really Besto's style. He generally says when something's pissed him off, and he's not been afraid to do so in the past. But he seemed to understand the reasons behind it all. So I think sometimes we can perhaps put too much emphasis on Ed Smith here, when actually there's a bigger conversation being had. And, you know, Besto turns up now available for the next two test matches, and actually it doesn't look like such a bad scenario for Besto now. I mean I would pick him for the third test.
Like, this rotation policy debate has been going on for the last few weeks. I don't have any issues with that. It's more just the way the whole moment things come out has been worrying, because I just think while everyone is really understanding of Josh Butler, Besto and the others not playing, I feel like this situation's not been given the right level of clarity, and I think the player is going to suffer in terms of the criticism that's going to come from this, basically.
Going back to the test itself, we've not talked about India's spinners yet, who were both brilliant. Two of the three were brilliant. Ravichandran Ashwin had a worldie of a test match, taking 8 wickets and scoring his 5th test century. He's one of the best players of his generation, really, at the absolute peak of his game, at a brilliant series in Australia, obviously, and now doing the business here. And Tar, a stunning debut from Axar Patel, who is yet another Indian debutant who looks test ready from day one.
Yeah, rightly that there's plenty of praise for Ashwin, who's, you know, just typically brilliant. But I thought Axar Patel bowled beautifully on debut. In that first test, Ashwin, he sort of lacked that support from the other end, from the other two spinners, Nadeem and Washington. But here he had it. I mean, Patel, he played that sort of Jadeja role to perfection. That low arm gives him that flatter trajectory that we've seen in white ball cricket. But that pace was sort of perfect for this pitch as well, because it sort of gave the gave that sort of extra spit off the surface that, and when there was already sort of enough bite. What did he take? 8 wickets? I mean, I think it's often the case with spinners that come in, the subcontinent home spinners, and they come in and do immediately well at home, but it gets taken for granted. We just assume that because they're not playing batsmen who are that proficient against spin, or and that they're used to bowling in these conditions all the time, it's easy to overlook. But this is still a test match debut, and to look so at home immediately is really impressive, and just a brilliant achievement. His batting returns weren't great for a guy who's batting at 7, but if Ashwin's now a nick, that gives India a far better balance too.
Yeah, I think that balance could be really important coming to the day-night test. I mean, you wouldn't expect it to be a green seamer, but equally, that the ball just aids seams a bit more anyway, swingers especially. And the conditions will need to be slightly... I mean, if the pink ball gets roughed up, that's a big issue because of the visibility being low already. So if India want to go in with 3 pacers, but they also want to pick Kuldeep, who's, you know, a spinner who can kind of break through whenever, I think Ashwin's performance gives them real flexibility there, because he can now bat at 7 without the insurance of kind of like a proper number 8 behind him. So they could go, if they wanted, Bumrah, Sharma, Siraj, Kuldeep, rather than having to have like sort of another bowling all-rounder in the side. I think that they might keep Akshar, and he did bowl brilliantly. But I think that, yeah, Ashwin's performance has sort of given them a new level of flexibility, I think.
On England's batting, England were bowled out for 134 and 164, as well as India bowled. What do you think went wrong with the bat, Joe? And do you think there'll be any changes made to the top order for the third test with Bairstow back in the squad and Crawley likely to be fit again? He's been included in the squad for that third test match.
I think they just got undone by a world-class spinner on a helpful pitch. It's a similar story to what we've seen before. I mean, it's the same old arguments, how much quality spin in these conditions do a lot of these batsmen see? There's not a lot of test caps in this England side, particularly in this batting side. Their learning on the job is difficult. I don't think we expect them to be averaging 40-50 come the end of the series. That's certainly not the more junior batting partners. But they do need to be sticking around and at least offering support to Root or Stokes if you can get going. Burns has struggled, Lawrence has struggled in this series. Looking ahead to the third test, a lot depends on, I mean, the Crawley they think will be fit, but how much batting will he be able to do? How much practice will he be able to do in the lead up to the third test? That's quite a crucial question for me when considering whether he comes in. If he was ready to go, I'd play him. And I would bring in Bairstow as well. And I would certainly drop Burns, who I think he's had a reasonably lucky England career in some ways. I think we're too quick to jump on players for having poor records. But Burns is averaging 30 from 42 knocks now in Test cricket. It's about the same as Sam Robson, who was dropped after 7 tests. Not much more than people like Alex Hales, Mark Stoneman. He's got a gritty Ashes 100. He's played some good knocks for England, but I think he's probably maybe escaped criticism to a certain extent. And I don't think he's looked like scoring runs in this series. So I would drop him for Crawley and probably bring in Bairstow for Lawrence as well. I think between Lawrence and Burns, I would say if one of them was to get a big score, I think Lawrence would be the more likely person to do that. So if any one was to miss out, it would be Burns for me. But I think if Bairstow is ready to go and Crawley is considered fit, then I'd bring them both in.
I think with Burns, he did have a really good Ashes series. But Ben, you wrote a piece on Burns and about how, quite interesting, how he gets out in kind of weird ways, but also he's had quite similar problems. He had a really bad series against Pakistan where he basically just got Shaheen. Afridi bowled really, really well against him and he really struggled, didn't get a score. And for a while, he struggled against spin. No bowler in Test cricket has got him out more often than Ross and Chase. And if Ross and Chase is getting him out regularly in the Caribbean or in England, you know, it's not a surprise to see him struggle against Ashwin. And I think Ashwin got him out now every single time that he's bowled at him.
Yeah, obviously a few things there. I mean, yeah, he did get worked over against Pakistan. I think Shaheen will work out over lots of players by the time he's done, and players who are, you know, better than Rory Burns, I think. So there's not too much shame in that. And I think you can, you know, as an opener, you're going to get a few low scores. And while that, you know, it's one of those things where if you're running a social media account, as we do at Wisden, you can quite easily put in quite a far back parameter in terms of, you know, since the start of the Pakistan series, Burns' average is, I think it's 9.75 now, which obviously sounds very bad. But I think that's only 8 knocks in total. And he's had a long break in the middle, you know, and has come and came into this test or this series without a huge amount of cricket behind him. I see what Joe's saying, and that I kind of don't see Burns making a big score. But equally, I don't think his problem with playing spin is exactly technical in the same way as it looked like with Sibley in the two tests in Sri Lanka, at least the first 3 innings in Sri Lanka. It more feels like, and the fact that Ross and Chase has made him his bunny sort of speaks to the fact of how he just finds ways to get out against spin in particular. I think that he has a way to kind of survive and get through for a bit, but his kind of feels like his scoring options just aren't really secure. So you kind of saw in the first innings of the first test, he kind of got through to 33, played okay, looked okay, then played a reverse sweep that went wrong. In this test, it was, you know, really hard conditions, battled through to into the 20s, and then tried to, you know, close the bat face on one and got sort of like a bit of a leading edge to slip. I think that, like, that there's stuff to work with. And the other thing we know with Burns is that we've been here before, and obviously, you know, a player can't keep having to bounce back from poor form until you start wondering if actually that's just their level of, like, some good bits, but also quite a long stretch of poor performance. But that Ashes 100, it's not just 100 in the Ashes, it was 100 in the Ashes on the back of, you know, intense scrutiny on his place. I mean, worked over by Boyd Rankin and Tim Murtagh against Ireland. And he kind of trusted his own, like, technique to be able to see him through most challenges. But he also understands his own technique and can tweak it and figure out what's going wrong and then come back stronger. So I agree with Joe. I think what they will do if Crawley is fully fit and they're happy with the amount of practice he's had, I think they'll go Sibley, Crawley, Bairstow. I personally would go Sibley, Burns, Bairstow, because I think Burns, it's, while, you know, the overall record isn't great, I think there's enough about him that, like, if there was anyone who was going to turn it round, I think you can reasonably expect that he might just be one of those players, I guess.
So you're writing off Zach Crawley again, Ben? We're back to where we started.
No, I mean, I think he could very easily come back in for the fourth test, but I think it's equally, you can be unfair to a player by, you know, selecting them based on an innings if you, you know, what's ages ago now when he won't have had much practice and, you know, where he'll, you know, looked a bit iffy in Sri Lanka. I think you're almost moving him from the line of fire slightly. But yeah, I think that there is a reasonable argument that Burns might make more runs the next test than Zach Crawley. I think that is just about where I'd lean at this stage.
If Burns is dropped for the next test and plays Crawley, I mean, he's just massively going to look back at that first innings and think, what if? Because he was batting better than Dom Sibley. He looked really comfortable in that first innings, flat deck, was playing spin quite well. There's a nice shot down the ground to Ashwin, I think. And then he just didn't need to play the reverse sweep. I know it's sort of uncool to criticise someone playing the reverse sweep nowadays, but it was more just the fact that he had other scoring options. He was playing quite well and he messed it up. At the same time, if he is dropped, I don't think he just falls out of England's plans. I think England have had a pretty stable batting group for the last, pretty much since Chris Littlewood took over. And he's been a part of that. And I think that they're treating this, you know, the last 2 years has pretty much been a cycle when I feel like Burns won't drop out that easily. I think they'll still, even if he's dropped the rest of the series, I think I can still sort of see him coming back in the summer, him still going to the Ashes, having actually faced Cummins, Stark and Hazelwood in 2019 and come out of it looking pretty good. So I think we have to start looking at tests, especially with the amount of England rotate now. We have to start looking at Test cricket as a squad game and not think of it as if someone's dropped, that's the end of their career. I'm saying this assuming that he's going to get dropped next test. I don't even know that, but there shouldn't be the assumption that his Test career is just going to be over now.
Yeah, I agree with that, Tara. I think that's a fair point. And when I was referring back to these openers of Stoneman, Hales, etc., a lot of them were discarded too quickly. And Burns has showed that he can do it at times. So I certainly wouldn't write him off. I think particularly in England, he's got a role to play. I just think this series, particularly given the lack of practice he had coming into it, is potentially a bit too much for him.
Yeah, I think the only thing for me in terms of his long-term plays as it depends how England end up viewing Ben Folkes at the end of this series. He could well, I mean, from how good he looks in this test, he could well, I mean, when he made himself undroppable before, that only lasted for two test matches and they did find a way to drop him. But if England do decide when they return to England they want to fit Ben Folkes and Josh Butler into the same 11, the only way to do that, I think, is to move someone up to that number three spot. And then you're looking at maybe Crawley and Sibley as your long-term thing. So I equally could see a scenario in which Burns slips down the pecking order reasonably quickly, while also recognising that him being left out doesn't have to be a death knell of sorts, I guess.
Tar, what's your moment of the week?
My moment of the week is one particular take from Ben Folkes. It was Dan Lawrence came on to bowl in India's second innings, got an off break to sort of rip past leg stump, and Folkes sort of just plucks it out with one hand. I think England reviewed it and it was a pretty silly review, they reviewed for the court behind. But it was just one of those things where I thought my eyes were playing tricks with me because his hand was so quick. And it was just, he's the one plus point of this test match for England because he was brilliant. I've mainly watched cricket in the era where we have wicketkeeper batsmen, not specialist wicketkeepers. So I think for me, that was probably the best Spurs test match wicketkeeping I've ever seen, really. Some of the stumping is ridiculous. I know Rishabh Pant kept really well. Folkes, to be fair, actually, you could say he did make a couple of errors, whereas I don't think Pant made any. But it was still sort of brilliant to watch. In terms of the whole wicketkeeping debate, don't really want to go there because I still think whatever Ben Folkes does with gloves is great, but what's going to get him the side is if he makes runs, which I think he's very much capable of. But at the end of the day, it's going to be what he does with the bat that determines whether he still has a long test career, really. He's very much capable of it, though.
Yeah, I think the Folkes Butler debate we've had before in the show, and it can get quite tedious. I think people generally underrate Folkes' batting and also underrate Butler's keeping. Butler's kept very well recently. We've had a few questions in asking how many tests Folkes would have played if he was Australian at the moment, which I think is fair. I think Folkes is very, very unlucky to have played as few tests as he has done. But I think as a lot of people remarked the last week, there's not an obvious way to get him into the England side away from Asia. But you definitely see the benefit of having a world-class keeper. Because I think he kind of creates chances that aren't really there for like standard keepers. And a lot of people who know a lot more about wicketkeeping than me commented on how good he was. Adam Gilchrist, Sarah Taylor, Matt Prior, Kieran Moray, all saying that he was very, very good this test. I think there was one other really, really good plus point for England this test match that Joe briefly mentioned at the top, and that was Ollie Stone. He bowled with real pace. His body held up well in his first test for 18 months. And I kind of think that, fitness permitting, not only is he a shoo-in for the Winter Ashes if he can bowl at that pace with that consistency, but also I really wonder if he can properly challenge Wood and Archer for the number one, like, genuine quick berth at some point in the English summer. I'm not sure if he'll play again this series, but, you know, I think it's easy to forget that before Archer became eligible to play for England in 2019 and before Wood had that test match in St Lucia in early 2019, Stone was a guy who had an amazing recent first-class record behind him and was kind of seen as the guy who could be that guy to lead England's fast bowling attack in somewhere like Australia. And because of Archer and Wood and also injuries, he's not really had that opportunity. And for him to have that test match, this test match, I thought was really, really encouraging for England.
As Nick Knight pointed out, I think on 17 different occasions, he is part of the ECB fast bowling contract system. It was really confusing. I have to admit, I drifted off at one stage about kind of 6 in the morning and I woke up and Nick Knight was saying exactly the same thing as he was when I fell asleep previously. I wasn't sure if I was some sort of alternate reality. But anyway, it is a point worth making, but perhaps not quite as many times as he did.
One thing we haven't mentioned yet that was a major talking point earlier on in the test is DRS. A couple of howlers earlier in the test. I guess the first one wasn't really a howler. The Rohit Sharma non-stumping, where the third umpire kind of just made a hasty judgment call, deciding that wasn't out, that Rohit might have had a spike behind the line. But the real howler was the referral that didn't check whether the ball flicked Rahane's glove when it did. And then there was also the Rohit LBW shout in the second innings where the on-field umpire decided that Rohit had played a shot when he very much hadn't played a shot after he was struck outside the line of off stump. Replay showed the ball would have hit the stumps and it would have been overturned. Go to you, DRS Ben. Do you think anything can be done to the protocols to avoid these errors? One of the listeners, Joe Newstadt, asks, do the rules need to change regarding DRS and batsmen playing a shot?
The no shot one is an interesting one because, I mean, so you presumably you have seen it if you're listening to this podcast, but if you haven't, Rohit was doing that thing where you hide your bat behind your pad to sort of trick the umpire into thinking you've played a shot. And the thing is that there is slightly more risk to the batsman in doing it that way than in just completely shouldering arms and kicking it away, because you do run the risk, I suppose, of the ball sort of bouncing up off your pad and taking a glove, for example. So there is more of a risk in doing that. So it's not, I probably wouldn't have said it was a shot, but equally I can just about see how you might just be convinced. The other thing is that the TV umpire at the moment, their job is to kind of decide on, you know, matters of fact in terms of, you know, is there evidence that the ball has hit the bat? Is there evidence that the ball would have gone on to hit the stumps? Using the technology available. Whereas a batsman playing a shot is a matter of opinion, even though most people might have one opinion and the umpire has a different one. I think once you take that, the context is that TV umpires aren't allowed to decide if a batsman has played a shot or not. They take that purely from the on-field umpire and then factor that into their reasoning. They don't judge on that after the team has taken a review. But I think you are sort of almost fundamentally changing the philosophy of DRS if you were to give the TV umpire say on that. What I would change is that at the moment the rules say that the on-field umpire aren't supposed to give the fielding team or anyone any information about the decision they've reached before they take a review. I can't see how that helps you get to the best decision, and I can't see how it stops. This was a pointless review as soon as England took it and they heard it was no shot offered because you knew that Rohit was way out. There was a shot offered because you knew that Rohit was way outside the line and England wouldn't have taken it if they'd known. And if nothing else, it wasted 2 minutes of the test match because you had to wait for a review that we all knew was pointless as soon as that was made. Umpires should be encouraged to say not out if they think he was playing a shot, and then England can say disagree, but we'll carry on. And then what happened then is it kind of just snowballed in terms of the rest of the decisions from then on. There was one proper howler, a few sort of judgment calls which could have gone either way, and by the end, there was no shortage of criticism of the TV umpire. With the, you know, Joe Root was given not out LBW with one that hit him very close to the stumps, but umpire's call showed that it was just outside the line, or the centre of the ball was just outside the line of the stump. So again, a reasonable call, even if it's one that some people felt the on-field umpire could have given out. I think that and it's interesting to see how cricket's sort of discussion cycle and media cycle turns in a test match on the basis of one shocker early on to then questioning every decision from then on out, and becoming, in a way, by the end, it was almost like football's bar, really, where you had every decision being sort of micro-analysed. But if that first decision happened, then the later decisions don't get scrutinised to the same extent either. I think that's sort of taken on the chin as sort of part of DRS for me. It was interesting just to see how that worked as well.
The Rahane won in the first innings, though, which didn't actually matter in the context of the game eventually. That was just completely ridiculous. I mean, that I can just about understand a brain fade on the part of the third umpire, on the TV umpire, to not follow it through. I mean, it's obviously bad, but I can just about understand it. But the fact they weren't able to then communicate that back to the TV umpire to still get the right decision. And then when they sent it upstairs for LBW, which was pitching about kind of 6 feet outside leg stump, the whole thing was just farcical. And England wouldn't have got their review back if it wasn't for Mark Butcher on commentary. Genuinely, I mean, that's obviously what led to that sequence of events where they realised they'd made a mistake. The England management went to speak to the match referee. That was just a kind of really good example of cricket just getting it completely wrong in a completely completely avoidable way. So that was frustrating. I think that's what really set the ball rolling in terms of this kind of scrutiny of the umpires, who I thought they'd had a really good game in the first test, but the wheels did come off rather in this latest test match.
Yeah, and arguably, Joe, they shouldn't have even got their review back at all, even with Mark Butch having raised the error by the letter of the law, which you'll be pleased to know that I have scrutinised thoroughly. It only says that a team can have their review reinstalled if there's a failure of the technology. It doesn't talk about the failure of the TV umpire to follow the protocols or anything. And unless Mr. Chowdhury is actually a robot, it's hard to call it a failure of the technology. It was just a failure of the third umpire.
I think we can all say that common sense prevailed, though, which is a good thing. Anyway, moving on from DRS. Joe, what's your moment of the week?
So my moment of the week actually came before the second test. I spoke to Jack Leach about 24 hours after England had completed that first test win, which was very nice of him. He sounded exhausted. He'd just done his column for Sky Sports as well. He'd obviously done quite a bit of media after the game. So it was very nice of him to speak to us. We actually asked to speak to him before the Sri Lanka series, and he said in the politest way possible that he didn't really want to talk at that point because he was fed up of talking about contracting sepsis and managing his Crohn's disease, and he actually wanted to do some bowling first, which I could completely understand, and it made for a better interview when I did eventually speak to him, because he had an extraordinary first test, obviously, withstanding that, or not withstanding, the pant assault against him, none for 79 from his first seven overs. It looked like England's, I would dispute what Tar said earlier, at the moment is England's best spinner. I would say Jack Leach is definitely England's best spinner personally, but it looked like India might have knocked England's best spinner out of the attack within his first eight overs of the series. So to come back in the way that he did, that magic dismissal of Rohit Sharma, I've already summed up Leach as a cricketer and what a kind of tenacious, resolute cricketer he's been, who hasn't really got his dues as an England spin bowler so far in his career. And look, he's not a world beater. He's not Ravi Ashwin, but I think he's England's best spinner by some distance. And it's taken England a while to wake up to that fact. But I think what we've seen so far this winter, 22 wickets in four tests, generally keeping a lid on the run rate, pants assault aside, I think he's done a really good job, and he was very honest about the treatment he got from Pant. He said he was shaken on the evening of day three. He said he was low. He doesn't play any white ball cricket. He's not really used to having that kind of treatment. But to come back the way he did, to get those couple of wickets early the next morning, and then that big wicket of Rohit Sharma. And I thought he bowled well again in the second test. I thought he was a bit unlucky not to get a few more wickets. And he is able to keep a lid on the run rate in a way that England's other spinners haven't really been able to do. So that hopefully goes well for the rest of the series. But beyond that, I think he is England's best spinner and should be picked in whatever conditions. Doesn't matter that he can't bat number eight. He's a reasonable tail ender. He's a better fielder than people give him credit for. And he should be picked because he's England's best spinner.
What would you do, though, Joe, with that number eight slot? It does seem a backwards way to sort of think about a test cricket team. You should pick your four best bowlers and then your seven best batsmen, let the rest take care of itself. But say England decide that their first choice attack is Jofra Archer, James Hansen, Stuart Broad, and then Jack Leach is their best spinner. What is the solution? I mean, is it just sucking up a slightly longer than ideal tail, or what?
It is tricky. You're right, that would be a long tail. I think Archer's got more to offer as a test batsman than we've seen so far, which, to be fair, is very, very little in test cricket. You would potentially have to look at Chris Wokes in that scenario as well. But I think there's a bigger drop-off in England's spinners than there is in their seamers. I think there's enough to work with in their seam attack to make sure that your number eight isn't a bunny. Whereas I think if you don't have Jack Leach as your number one spinner and Moen potentially drifts away, then I think the drop-off to the next spin bowler is quite significant. And I think, I mean, it's a bit of a cliche. I think if your top seven aren't scoring proper runs, then you're going to struggle to win many test matches anyway. And Broad, on his day, can still slap a quick 30. Leach can stick around. It's not the worst tail ever. We're not getting back to kind of Malali, Fraser, Tufnell days of the 90s. I think there's enough to get by. And let's be face it, when we get to Australia, England's tail never score any runs anyway, however good they're meant to be as batsmen.
Yeah, one more thing on Leach that is related actually to Ben's DRS speech is that I think England were and have been for a while, I thought, really nice in this test match. A lot of things went against them, and they reacted very calmly when the test basically couldn't have been going a whole lot worse. Won't get into a huge debate about it, but if you compared the reaction of Joe Root in England compared to the reaction of Virat Kohli when decisions went against India, I think there was quite a stark difference between the two of them. I think England have been quite nice for a while now.
Arguably too nice, you could say. I mean, for that that ghost glove of Vijinkya Rahane, if that had been the other way around, Virat Kohli would not have let that lie without being absolutely certain that it that all the replays had been looked and every possible angle had been looked at. I mean, he wasn't happy to accept he'd been clean bowled on the first morning, so he definitely wasn't going to accept a dodgy replay. But yeah, they have been nice. I mean, you know, England are also not faultless. We shouldn't, you know, eulogise them too much. They've got plenty of demerit points for swearing at South Africans and spectators this time last year. But you're right, that was nice to see Root being a gentleman in trying circumstances.
Yes, and away from that series, there was another brilliant test match in Bangladesh with West Indies winning the second and final test of the series by 17 runs to take the series 2-0. Nkrumah Bonner, Joshua De Silva and Alzari Joseph got scores of 19, 92 and 82 in the first innings to get West Indies up to 409. Bangladesh, without Shakib, scored 296 in response before rolling West Indies out for 117. Tajul Islam taking 4 for 36. Bangladesh chasing 231 looked good in the chase. They were 101 for 3, but regular wickets saw them fall short despite a valiant effort from Mehdi Hassan at number 8, who looked to be taking them close at the end. Rakeem Cornwall was the player of the match, taking 9 wickets for West Indies across the test. Billy Johnson asked how impressive were the West Indies, was the West Indies whitewash of Bangladesh given the circumstances under which it happened, and if possible, who has really staked their claim for a first team spot. I mean, I don't know exactly. I think it's going to be very difficult for West Indies to pick a top 7 after this, with Bonner, I think he was named player of the series, obviously Mayers in the first test, and Joshua Silva doing very well. And with so many players out, I think it's going to be quite interesting to see how West Indies shape up for the next test match.
Yeah, I've seen Carl Mez's average has dropped down to 87, which is just not good enough, really. So, you know, he's too low scores. He's in trouble. But yeah, I get what you mean. It's kind of hard to, because you have to respect why people have dropped out of the series. These are obviously, you know, the circumstances are pretty crazy. But then how can you not then reward what is an astounding achievement? To win Bangladesh is not easy. It's not been that easy in recent years. England drew their 1-1. Australia drew their 1-1. And then for West Indies to do what they've done, you know, it's important for Test match cricket to not just be centred on great contests between England and India and the other top nations. It's important for these series as well to be given their due and to have competitive games. So overall, it was great to see, and yeah, massive achievement from West Indies.
Yeah, the other challenge as well is it's not just those players that have come in and sort of staked a claim. It's the fact that the players who, you know, they have missed out for completely legitimate reasons, but the likes of Darren Bravo, Shamar Brooks, they haven't completely nailed their places down either. Especially Darren Bravo has obviously had a fantastic start to his Test career and looked like, to be honest, there was a time when he could have been the big 5 rather than big 4 with Darren Bravo as part of it. And he's fallen away quite dramatically and has kind of, you know, there's been loads of off-field stuff. He's really kind of struggled to kick on, I guess, for no reasons not entirely on his control, but that's still what the case is. But it's not just those players being out of form. It's the fact that there are other players who we know are very talented and who some in the West Indies would like to see playing Test cricket despite not having played much first-class cricket. So the likes of Nicholas Pooran, Shimon Hetmeyer, these are players who also could legitimately make cases for selection. So I think, yeah, they've got, in a way it's a good problem to have. Actually, they've probably got quite a lot of players on quite a similar level, but they're also all very different kinds of players. So yeah, it's an unenviable task. If I had to bet on it, Joshua De Silva would be in the team for a long time. Nkrumah Bonner, to me, although Carl Mayers was obviously the standout knock, he looked the player with the sort of the most solidity in a way. So I would bank on him and Kyle Mayers playing the next test, but for Bonner to stay on the team longer for me.
For any listeners with a particular interest in Bangladesh, cricket, I would recommend following the Twitter account Sykes Green Cricket Journal. It's a London-based Bangladeshi pundit. There's podcasts and video casts. Very good on Bangladesh cricket. Ben, what's your moment of the week?
Yes, it's obviously from the T20i series between South Africa and Pakistan, live on Sky Sports, unlike all the other international cricket at the moment. It was just a little moment with Tibrai Shamsi bowling to Mohammad Rizwan, who had a brilliant series, got 100. But he did an Andre Russell, I don't know if you remember from the IPL a few years back, where Andre Russell was running up to bowl and then looked like he was pulling out. So Shane Watson sort of relaxed, and then all of a sudden Russell clicked back into gear, bowled sort of like a nothing length ball outside the off stump, with which Watson sort of looked as it went through to the keeper and sort of like had that classic Shane Watson expression that he always has whenever he's, you know, LBW and can't believe it. Or so Ray Shamsi basically did the same thing, but as a spinner, sort of was running, was sort of walking in and sort of relaxed, and then all of a sudden gathered pace again and bowled it. Rizwan sort of didn't know what was going on, so kind of blocked it out. And then the umpire, in this case, called dead ball, which is probably fair enough if it's an attempt to distract the striker, but it was just an interesting variation from a bowler who's got plenty of them.
Yeah, I think Shamsi's moved up to number two in the T20i bowling rankings at the moment. Pakistan won that series 2-1, won the first game by 3 runs and the decider by 4 wickets. Mohammad Rizwan had a very good series, scored 100 in the first game, 51 in the second and 42 in the third. Tar?
Yeah, I should say I watched a bit of that series as well. And Usman Khadr, who's the son of Abdul Khadr, looks a proper bowler. He was sort of ragging it square in one spell, I think in the second T20i or the first, I can't remember. Has a lovely googly on him and looks a proper bowler. So one to keep an eye on.
Moving on, in New Zealand, England women have played 2 warm-up games there, 2 high-scoring games. They won the first, lost the second. Runs for Nat Skiver in the first game, she scored 75. And there were 50s for Danny Wyatt, Heather Knight and Sophie Eccleston in the second. I think the second warm-up game got a bit funky because the scorecard reads that Knight scored 250s in that game. The ODI series between England and New Zealand kicks off a week today. And finally, we're just going to play a quick interview with a 16-year-old called Will Gaffney, who set up a charitable initiative called Bat for a Chance. Will, thanks for joining us. What is Bat for a Chance and how did you set it up?
So Bat for a Chance is a cricket charity which provides cricket kit to kids less fortunate than us all across the world who may struggle to come by it financially or even where they live. And it's set up off the back of me going on tour out to Sri Lanka at a young age and sort of seeing firsthand the need for kids and how much of an impact cricket has on these kids' lives.
Mm. And you're only 16, so how did you actually set this up?
So sort of reflecting on the tour, it was quite the magical experience. And the moment that stuck with me was playing in Kandy on a coconut mat against a village team who only had a couple of sets of pads between them. And I wanted to give back, get involved. I sent out a couple of emails and then it's kind of just exploded from there, really.
And how many people does Bat for a Chance provide kit for at the moment?
It varies. We get it to new places pretty much every month at the moment, it seems. So far, we've reached the Lebanon, the Shatila Refugee Project out there, in coordination with the MCC Foundation, who I work really, really closely with. Sarah and her team out there are fantastic. And I'm proud to be joining their Young Ambassadors team as well. And most notably, recently, we got kit out to Sri Lanka in between the first and second test, funnily enough, and we were lucky enough to have Kumar Sangakkara handing over the gears for us, which is a real honour and something that myself and all involved will treasure for the rest of our lives. It was a really magical moment.
That's really cool. So what can listeners do if they're listening to this and thinking, yeah, I want to help out? Where would you direct them?
Just literally search into Google, Bat for a Chance. Our website should come up, and then there's 2 sort of donate forms on the website, one of which is the kit. We get a lot of secondhand donations. The village cricket community in the UK is second to none, and it really helps us out. And yeah.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, Will. Thanks, Taha. Thanks, Ben. Thanks, Joe. This has been the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. If you enjoy the show, tell your friends. And if you're feeling especially kind, why not leave us a 5-star review on the podcast app? And if you like YouTube videos, we are now on YouTube. Not this podcast, but we have short 20-25 minute discussions at the end of each India-England test. Cheers.
Podcast Network.